You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for April 10th, 2015. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the National American Taxpayers Horizon, Free Enterprise, Patriot Liberty, Prosperity, Family Values, Defending Freedom, Concerned Citizens Action Network Committee Fish Fry, it's the Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
That was so perfect.
It hurt me to say that, but it's so perfect. Way to go, Blue Gal. Yeah. And it's a front group. I tell you, it's a front group. Who's one of these people?
Ted Cruz has started three political action committees, and they've raised $31 million in a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, Drift Glass, is the political story.
Yeah, it is.
Right now, that's the story that the media is covering.
Uh-huh. He's got millions of dollars. He's got a lot of money.
$31 million. Yeah, so that's how you get elected. And
do you have $31 million, Joe Scarborough?
Oh, no.
Yeah, well,
we're
yes,
doing,
you do.
We're
yeah.
doing something wrong. I'm 501c3. Let's do a professional at 501c3. But then I have to email everybody every day and ask them for $3, three or
you
four
got $3?
Times a day.
You got $3? You know what? If you send me $3, I'll talk to Elizabeth Warren. And you know, apparently throwing $3 down that rat hole didn't get Chewy Garcia elected. So
no,
sorry
no,
to hear that.
Didn't.
But
no, and
but,
Rahm Emanuel was reelected without your $3. So fuck you. Yeah,
maybe
okay.
maybe. Hey, maybe if I were a better person, Blue Gal, maybe if I sent that $3 in, then something
it's
Chewy
all
Garcia.
Your fault. So that's the story. Ted Cruz raises $31 million in a week is what we're going to talk about when we talk about politics this week. Except we also have to talk about Rand Paul losing his shit in 2 days in a row. And he's just having a real bad week. And it's sad for him. But Tweety, Chris Matthews did really lose it over the front groups.
He almost said something true. I mean, he almost, you know, if he were to sustain this for like 2 days, he'd be out of work. Yeah. So that's not going to happen. But he did just, I don't know what, as you said, I don't know who pissed in his coffee.
Yeah, that's, Frixenmeyer said that, yeah.
I don't know what happened, but suddenly, I don't know if they're not, he's not getting his envelopes full of cash or whatever. But just remember, Chris Matthews was one of the puppet masters behind the scenes to get rid of Phil Donahue.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Matthews
if we're talking too much peace.
Yeah, he was too liberal.
And Chris Matthews, first of all, Chris Matthews has a man crush on Rand Paul.
Yeah.
And I think Chris Matthews likes Rand Paul because Rand Paul gives him an out for being a Reagan Democrat and being able to call bullshit on the Iraq War when before the Iraq War, he swallowed it.
He sure did.
So this is his out is, you know, I am now willing to call bullshit on it. Because Rand Paul is brave enough to do so, and nobody has to remember Phil Donahue.
No, nobody does. Nobody. This is the we'll talk about this a little bit later. But the I'm still cruising through my archives, and the power of forgetting things is just astonishing when it comes to over the course of time. But let's get back to Ted Cruz and $31 million.
Yeah. That's all the story we have about him this week is three political action committees, not one, three. I don't know why you have to do three, but you have to do three. Mm-hmm. And they're all, I didn't go and look at the titles of them, but they're all based on something like restoring our country. Because, you know, we at the National American Taxpayers Horizon, Free Enterprise, Patriot Liberty, Prosperity, Family Values, Defending Freedom, Concerned Citizens Action Network Committee are here to take America back.
Thus begging the question, back from whom exactly? Who took your country?
As a mother and a patriot.
Yeah, yeah, yes. You're both, honey. You're definitely both, a mother and a patriot.
I guess we should tell people. That's good trivia.
Yeah.
When we do our professional left trivia, as a mother and a patriot was the letter that Liz Cheney sent out to her supporters when she pulled out of the Senate race.
Right.
So we use that around our house all the time. What do you want? What are we having for dinner? Well, as a mother and a patriot.
A patriot, yeah. So what time is homework? Well,
as
let me tell
mother,
you.
As a mother and a patriot.
We have a lot of catchphrases around our house.
We do. And Bun Bun Stew
Bun Bun Stew
is another
still
one.
Very popular.
I want Mike Kay to know that. His rabbit. Bun Bun Stew. So anytime something exciting happens around, we say Bun Bun Stew.
And today we should point out that today is the 150th anniversary of an important date in America.
Yes.
History.
Tell everybody what day it is. We're recording this on Thursday.
Thursday, April 9th.
And it is the anniversary of...
The day that the noble Southern gentleman who fought valiantly in the War of Northern Aggression finally had to surrender to the Yankee Devils at Appomattox Courthouse. But you know what? The South will rise again.
The
and
South
you know
will
what?
Rise again.
It fucking does. Every few years, it just comes back.
You know? Yeah.
And what we have learned, okay, boys and girls, what have we learned over the last 150 years from the, this was the anniversary of the surrender at Appomattox Courthouse. From there to Jim Crow, to civil rights, to, hey, let's repeal voting rights.
Yeah.
You have to keep your foot on these people's neck forever until they breed out, until their kids, their children's children's children look back at mommy and daddy with shame and some degree of confusion as to how they have been so fucked up. Mm-hmm. You have to keep these people on a leash. And what happened? This is what happened. This is how we got to where we are. Nixon took them off the leash.
Yeah.
Nixon walked them right into the Republican Party and Reagan put them in charge.
Yep.
And now everything that's fucked up about this country, everything that's broken about our politics can be traced back to the single act of importing the bigots and sociopaths from the Democratic Party, which is where they were, the Dixiecrats, into the Republican Party, giving them actual power and then turning them loose and spending billions of dollars building a media empire that feeds their own paranoia and their own rage and their own bigotry back to them over and over again. Because that's all they've been listening to for the last, we have an article about Rush Limbaugh later on, for the last quarter of a century, Rush Limbaugh has been taking a dump in their skulls every day. And that's why American politics, and that's why Ted Cruz has $31 million in a bank account.
Well, and Rush Limbaugh is a millionaire.
Oh, multi-millionaire.
Ted Cruz is a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
I think every senator but one is a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Every cable news host makes a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a media and a Senate, U.S. Senate, and a media and billionaire financiers of the political structure, mm-hmm, and the media.
Yep.
And it's all painted over with money.
Money.
Huge amounts of money. And if you don't mind, because I'm worried about how long it's going to take and it will help me time it.
Please.
I want to talk about this article in the March 16th issue of The New Yorker. It is a book review. And if you read The New Yorker, you know that they do essays on a great many books. This is by Jill Lepore. I think she pronounces her name Lepore, maybe Lepore. It's called Richer and Poorer, Accounting for Inequality. And because I'm very interested in that kind of topic, I read the whole thing. But there's two subjects in this article that I want to cover in our podcast today. One is a book called The Age of Acquiescence, The Life and Death of American Resistance to Organized Wealth and Power. The author is Steve Frazier, and his book is mentioned in this article in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. Steve Frazier fumes that what's gone wrong with political discourse in America is that the left isn't willing to blame anyone for anything anymore.
Okay.
There used to be battle cries, no more kings, down with fat cats, damn the moneycrats. Frazier longs for the passion and force with which Americans of earlier generations attacked aggregated power. Think of the way Frederick Douglass wrote about slavery. Ida B. Wells wrote about lynching. Ida Tarbell wrote about Standard Oil. Upton Sinclair wrote about the meatpacking industry. And Louis Brandeis wrote about the money trust. These people weren't squeamish about villains. To chronicle the rise of acquiescence, Frazier examines two differences between the long 19th century and today. The first Gilded Age in the 19th century, despite its glaring inequities, was accompanied by a gradual rise in the standard of living. The second, by a gradual erosion of the standard of living. In the first Gilded Age, everyone from reporters to politicians apparently felt comfortable painting plutocrats as villains. In the second, this is somehow forbidden.
Uh-huh.
And I emphasize somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What, we don't know how, why. We don't know why it's forbidden.
Those are what I call the razor in the apple.
Yep.
That's
somehow.
You know
that's the somebody... razor in the apple. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Always is.
If the first Gilded Age was full of sound and fury, he writes, the second seemed to take place in a padded cell. Frazier argues that while progressive era muckrakers ended the first Gilded Age by drawing on an age-old tradition of dissent to criticize prevailing economic, social, and political arrangements, today's left doesn't engage in dissent. It engages in consent, urging solutions that align with neoliberalism, technological determinism, and global capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Why not blame the financial industry? Why not blame the Congress that deregulated it? Why not blame the system itself? Because, Frazier argues, the left has been cowed into silence on the main subject at hand. What we could not do, what was not even speakable, was to tamper with the basic institutions of financial capitalism. Mm-hmm. And on this page of The New Yorker, March 16th, 2015, page 31, from mm-hmm. which I just read to you,
mm-hmm.
it's a two columns of it are the article, and the third column is an ad. The ad is for a special Know Your Value series on Morning Joe with Micah Brzezinski, Women Who Run Things.
Yay! I know how much you love her, so be nice to her. It's not her fault that she's...
She's doing this special Know Your Value series on how women in the boardroom can demand their worth.
That's right. As long as you're in the boardroom. And apparently you hike your skirt up to your chin.
Oh, her skirt's up to her chin and her Milano Blahniks are on. And she's got, you know, her high heels and her legs and her hands stuffed in her pockets. And she knows her value.
And yep. As long as you're willing to be completely subservient to a loudmouth, boorish, right-wing asshole who sits right next to you and makes twice what you do, you can get what you want in this world. And,
right.
and you got to live in Manhattan. Sorry, that's
yeah.
also...
Well, that's the center of the world. According to Micah Brzezinski, that is the center of the world. So this I kept... there is no mention of the blogosphere anywhere in this article.
No.
Because...
There is no blogosphere. It's gone.
It's all gone. What if you gave Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells, Ida Tarbell, Upton Sinclair, and Louis Brandeis $1 million a year and told them, you can be on TV, but you can't say the Republicans are the problem.
Yeah. Then you'd have...
You have to say both sides.
Then you'd have our news media.
Well, then you'd still have slavery, lynching, Standard Oil, meatpacking industry, and the money trust, which is what you've got.
Yeah, that's exactly what you'd have. But now here's, if you gave them $1 million and said, keep doing what you're doing, you would have
that was what was going on in the late 19th century is there were magazines and outlets that did pay them to do their writing. So there was that, institutional support for what they were doing.
Uh-huh.
I'm not saying they got rich off of it, but
no.
there was institutional support for what they were doing, which...
Hey, Mike Royko.
We bloggers haven't been able to do that somehow.
In fact, we're the opposite. Well, now, but here's the thing, and this is what jumped out at me hard from going through my archives.
Yeah.
Was you used to have villains.
Yeah.
In 2002, 2003, 2004, the villains were liberals.
Yes.
Those dirty, dirty liberals. It was very clearly, this is a clear, stark portrait that was painted by the media, by the right-wing media, by the reasonable conservatives like David Brooks. They all painted the same picture. There were the reasonable people on one side of the issue who understood that blah, 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 we need to invade Iraq because George Bush, and tax cuts, by the way, tax cuts are a great idea. We're never going to have deficits again. Everything's fine. And then there were the crazy, crazy liberals. There was an us and there was a them. It was clear and as bright as day. They're good guys. There were villains. Then it turned out they in this equation, the liberals, were right about Bush and were right about tax cuts and were right about deregulation and were right about Iraq. And suddenly... The same people who had clearly and starkly created a Manichaean worldview, us versus them, right and wrong, suddenly all of them in one fucking afternoon became both siderists. Well, let's all agree that everyone was wrong. Everyone got this wrong. Both sides have merits and both sides have defects. Both sides have some of the truth, but not all of the truth. And that, over the course of a long weekend, I swear to God, became the coin of the realm, the holy church, and the lingua franca, the mother tongue of media, like mm-hmm. that. It happened mm-hmm. overnight. And while we were busy fighting the battle of, but we were right. We were just swept aside. The fact that we exist at all and that we were right about everything and that we continue to be right about everything is a constant, painful reminder that people like Chuck Todd and Joe Scarborough should be unemployed. They have no business speaking for this country. They have no business having a microphone at all. They should have blogs. They should be off writing angry columns about people like me. But they have no business dominating our national dialogue. But they do. And as long as they do, we're not going to have any villains. Because
well, let me get into the second part of this article, which is the other book. It is called Our Kids. Let me find the full title here. Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis by Robert Putnam. And in this book, Robert Putnam tells stories about children in poverty. Because I'm reading from the article again, because stories contain one kind of truth and numbers another, many writers mix and match telling representative stories and backing them up with aggregate data. Putnam, though, doesn't so much mix and match as he does split the difference. He tells stories about kids, but presents data about the economy. That's why Our Kids, the book, has heaps of victims, but not a single villain. I know that it gets really bad. Not a single villain.
Mm-hmm.
Tampering with the basic institutions of financial capitalism is not on Putnam's to-do list. His final chapter, called What is to be Done, includes one table, one chart, many stories, and this statement. Here is Putnam's What is to be Done about our kids in poverty. The absence of personal villains in our stories does not mean that no one is at fault. At fault are, quote, social policies that reflect collective decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as we have some responsibility for those collective decisions, we are implicated by our failure to address removable barriers to others' success.
Mm-hmm.
Putnam proposes changes in four realms: family structure, parenting, school, and community. His policy recommendations include, and here's the list, this is what he thinks should happen: expanding the earned income tax credit and protecting existing anti-poverty programs, implementing more generous parental leaves, better child care programs, state-funded preschool, equalizing the funding of public schools, providing more community-based neighborhood schools, increasing support for vocational high school programs and for community colleges, ending pay-to-play extracurricular activities in public schools, and developing mentorship programs that tie schools to communities and community organizations.
Mm-hmm.
That's his list of what should happen.
Now, may I just say, my list is longer and more aggressive than that, and so is yours, but everything on that list, everything.
Is Bill de Blasio's list.
Yeah, we would find a very comfortable home on one side of the political aisle.
Oh, now here's what Jill Lepore says. All of these ideas are admirable. Many are excellent. None are new. And at least at the federal level, few are achievable. The American political imagination has become as narrow as the gap between rich and poor is wide.
You know what's even narrower than the American political imagination? The razor in that apple.
The razor in that apple is very, very narrow. And there is nowhere in this article that says that laundry list of things, as you said, would pass in 2 weeks if Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House again.
Fuck, long weekend.
Yeah.
over a four-day weekend. First of all, Harry, I don't care if you're one-eye Harry. We're passing this shit. Okay.
Get busy.
And boom, boom, boom. We're done. Okay, yeah. What else you got? You know, yeah. I can go back to drinking now because we did all this shit.
I passed 261 bills in 2 years. I've done that. Yeah. Not done. Hard.
But that's the thing. We are, not you and I. It is maddening. And it is, from a distant perspective, fascinating mm-hmm. to see how far around a problem
yep.
people like this will walk to avoid stating the obvious. It really is the same analogy I've used a million times. It's an alcoholic family where dad is a psycho, drunk, abusive drunk, and nobody in the family is allowed to talk about it because dad will beat the shit out of him. Roger Ailes is the drunk. Roger Ailes and Rush Limbaugh and those people are sitting at the center of our political discourse dictating terms, and everyone tiptoes around them because they have money, because they got a shitload of money. And this is, you and I were ticking back and forth. Let's see. Right-wing demagogues who hate unions, intellectuals, homosexuals, and women, are terrified of foreigners, have identified a small minority in their midst on whom they blame everything, and are backed by crackpot right-wing industrialists. Welcome to Germany, 1929.
And I didn't want to go there and talk and make this, you know, the what is the law, Godwin's law? We talked about this at breakfast this morning, that, you know, I really didn't want to go full Godwin's law on this, but when you watch the shooting, when you watch the Walter Scott video, where, and by the way, I just the writer in me loves that his name is Walter Scott, because that is such a 19th century hero name. I mean, it's Dickensian. It's absolutely amazing just to have that name out there. And of course, prayers to his family and support for his family and from the tragedy of this. Go ahead.
It'll stay in the memory. It'll stay in people's
memory. But Walter Scott will stay in the memory. Right.
Exactly.
Right. But the fact that the police can shoot you in the back, and you and I both said, it doesn't matter if this particular individual cop is found guilty of murder.
Yeah.
That is so, I mean, that's justice for the family, and I would be grateful for that.
Right.
But from the standpoint of the overall, what does this mean for the nation? What it means for the nation is we've all learned now that if you're an African-American male, you can be shot in the back by a cop.
Or choked to death on the streets.
Or choked to death. And you're still dead, regardless of what happens after that.
And they can do that.
And they can do that.
And what's the lesson we take? What's the lesson any sane person would take away is, oh, my God, this is tragic. What's the lesson that the advocates for this kind of behavior, the people who are very comfortable living in that world. It's the same lesson they took away from Stand Your Ground, which is shoot the witness.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the witness. You're fine.
Oh, and Texas now is suggesting that.
Yes. Texas has, people were saying this yesterday, no videotape, no crime.
Mm-hmm.
No witness, no crime. This is Trayvon Martin. As long as the other guy's dead, you're fine. You get to walk. And there's a word for this. It's called lynching.
Yep.
It's very clear what's going on here. These are lynchings. They're not in the public square. Although when they were in the public square, the reason that people wore hoods is precisely because there'd be no witnesses. And under those hoods, 9 times out of 10, who would you find? The city fathers, the cops, the mayor of the town, who are all cool with that. What you watch
Chief
was a
lynching. Chief of police. Yep.
And the degree of comfort with which discomfort with which we've approached this is a measure of how far away from talking about this truthfully as that we are. There's a Texas-sized solution to this problem, which is there's a proposal before the Texas state legislature to make recording police illegal.
Yeah.
Problem solved. Get rid of the witnesses. Make it illegal. That way you can shoot the guy who's filming the film, because filming the lynching, because he's now broken the law too. I doubt it'll pass, but it was someone's immediate reaction to cops getting filmed, cops getting caught doing a lynching.
Yep.
Their reaction was quick, get rid of the evidence, burn the tapes.
Yep. Burn the tapes, it's Nixonian, absolutely.
Not fix the problem, destroy the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a systemic problem. That is not a problem in one little place or another little place. That is an attitude problem. That if you approach this tragedy, like Ben Carson did, apparently he was being interviewed by Chris Cuomo.
He said both sides. We haven't seen it yet, but Shock sent it to us. Both sides.
He said both sides. Yeah, and which reminds me a little bit of when Marco Rubio was on Comedy Central.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yes, I do. He was on Jon Stewart.
He made the mistake of sitting across from someone who was going to ask him really hard questions. And he said, I swear to God, both sides, like 15 times in a row.
Yep.
You can tell when you've caught someone. When you've caught your crazy Uncle Liberty or Rand Paul or Marco Rubio or Ben Carson, when you've caught them too far away from their ideological home base to tag up, you've caught them out there.
Or as you said this morning at breakfast, when the amount of red meat, bleeding red meat they're holding in their hands is too much to hide.
Mm-hmm. That's when you have to go
both sides. Or Rush Limbaugh is just an entertainer.
Rush Limbaugh is just an entertainer and both sides anyway, because, you know, Rachel Maddow is just as bad. Yep. And which leads us on a Mary Chase right back to like people like David Brooks.
Well, and it leads us on a Mary Chase to the conversation that you and I had about, I don't want to be the other side that says those people about conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
And you pointed out,
sorry,
you're not the mirror image of someone saying those liberals, so, you know, they'll say anything, because no, you can actually prove that what the conservatives are saying is a lie.
Yeah, except if you step inside conservative world.
Well, that's it. That's it. If all you watch is Fox News, then that's the fact-free zone. Yeah.
And if all you watch is the Sunday morning talk shows, then both sides. Yeah. Because, and here's the thing, the Iraq war was a catastrophic failure, and we were lied into it, is printed on the liberal letterhead that we all get from Commander Marcos, right? Yeah. It's printed 44-point railroad font.
Mm-hmm.
On the conservative side, 44-point railroad font, Barack Obama is from Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
The font size is the same. The bold face is the same, but one of them is true and one of them is a gigantic fucking lie by a bunch of bigots.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that, well, we're not going to talk about the content of anything you say. We're just going to talk about the volume with which you speak. We're going to talk about the font size of your complaints, and we'll compare them. And, oh, look, see, they're pretty much both the same. Liberals use this big font size to talk about, well, we won't say that. And conservatives use the same font size to talk about Benghazi. So pretty much both sides are doing the same thing.
Rachel Maddow has an hour-long show, and so does Hannity.
Exactly.
So, you know, they're same.
And it's such – and I cannot emphasize enough how quickly this language – smothered debate in this country, because the alternative would have been to actually litigate the treasons and high crimes and criminal incompetencies of the Bush administration, actually drag them out of the
light. Or the banks.
Or the banks.
You know, you could have done it that way, too. I mean, I realize that we kind of lumped all of those together, mm-hmm. but the banks or BP or all of the fracking companies that pollute the water that we're drinking.
You can
hold powerful people accountable for what they do.
And the reason I emphasize the Iraq war and all that surrounded it is that there were so many people in the media who were complicit.
Yep.
There were so many people who went right along with it, who went right along because that was where the money was. That's how you made a living. You made a fine living calling people like me and people like you un-American traitors. And then the same people got the same paycheck by flipping over and saying, oh, pretty much everybody's wrong. And nobody lost their job. Nobody in the media really lost their job.
Well, this is this is what I stood dumbfounded in front of Jon Stewart last night, who was calling for firings at Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
I mean, good for you, John, calling for accountability with Rolling Stone. And it was, I mean, it was in your face, blatant, to say that the report was punishment enough. The report that they failed at journalism was punishment enough. That's what the publisher said. Yeah. And that is blatant. However, everybody who supported the Iraq war from the media still has a job, still has a seat at the table. Mm-hmm. There's no accountability. Why do you expect accountability with Rolling Stone when that is New York, Manhattan, high-rise offices? As long as you've got that, there is no accountability for being wrong, obviously. No.
And once these people were let off the hook, once these people learned that there'd be no accountability for anything they said, game over. Because there's no point in having a conversation with anybody about anything when you can make any shit up you want. The only thing that matters in that war of all against all, where it doesn't matter how many liars are put up on Meet the Press, because Chuck Todd's never going to call them on it, is the size of the megaphone and the size of your wallet. Once you exile facts and history from the conversation, all that matters is how big you are and how loud you are, how much money you have. And that's the conversation.
This is why Dick Cheney has a book deal. This is why John McCain can run for office again. Although I think he's running for office again because Cindy still wants him out of the House. Let's talk about David Brooks and Lincoln, shall we?
Okay. Let's talk about David Brooks. And a quick shout out to Chewy Garcia.
Yeah.
I just want to mention that Rahm Emanuel won. The machine still lives in Chicago. Mm-hmm. The machine, as people who read my blog for the last many years know, I occasionally write in fits and starts about Chicago and Illinois politics. This is the triumph of the Daily Machine.
Yeah.
Not the blue collar Daily Machine of the 60s. This was the triumph of R2-D2, the second Daily, the Richie Daily, who took the machine politics out of the bungalow belt, out of the union shop, and moved it into the consultant's office, the contractor's office, or the contract consultant's office, the lawyer's office, and into the Gold Coast.
Yep, yep.
And those are the people who footed the bill to make an asshole like Rahm Emanuel the mayor for a second term. And I really feel, I know several people who still work in city service, the city of Chicago. I feel for them because the martinets and goons that are running the show just below the surface are insufferable and terrible. And I feel sorry for those good people who try to do good work on behalf of you, the taxpayer, and have to put up with this asshole for another who knows how many years. But yes, let us move on to David Brooks, shall we?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we'll see what happens with Rahm. I mean, we saw the softer side of Rahm on the advertising that he put out.
We did. Somebody came in and said, you have to say this, and then you get to win.
Yeah.
Okay.
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 Well, yeah, David Brooks took a little journey, a little moral journey, a little sojourn into Lincoln Land.
And can we just full disclosure,
mm-hmm.
say that we are recording this podcast from Springfield, Illinois.
Yes.
Where next month, early next month, they will be doing a reenactment of the Lincoln funeral and
yes,
the train.
Will.
And this is a big deal. We're going to have, I mean, it is Lincoln Land anyway. That's what this area is. Lincoln's law office is here, and the whole tourism of the city is based on Lincoln. And
every third thing is named Lincoln or Abe or Abraham Lincoln.
Yep.
And I learned all of what I know about Lincoln on the streets. Like I learned about stuff. You know? But I.
So we are steeped in Lincoln down here, and that's awesome. But
and the thing is, you don't have to be. You don't have to understand how hilariously wrong and really morally depraved David Brooks is and his abuse of Lincoln. He starts his column by talking about, I have an election year tradition. I go down to the Lincoln Memorial and I masturbate and I think about the stars.
No, he doesn't say that.
No, he doesn't. But he says, you know, he goes down to the Lincoln Memorial and basically thinks deep thoughts and thinks about democracy, and it's pretty awesome. It's pretty fucking awesome. I don't know if he knows what – I think he goes down to the Fox Studios and does that because I haven't never seen him around the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. But maybe he does. But he apparently read a book on Lincoln and reads a lot of books on Lincoln. And so with that sort of stuck in his brain, he decided to drag every issue through the Lincolnification of David Brooks. He was going to add some Lincoln to it and make it a conversation about morality. And this is something that is distinctively different about David Brooks in the last year or two, because he's such an utter and abject failure when it comes to talking about math and history and facts and foreign policy and shit like that. He's decided to talk about morality. There's no metrics in morality. You can just talk about moral principles and moral authority and the breakdown of morality in America, and you don't have to prove anything, which is a great value to someone who is a congenital liar like David Brooks, who's conducting a long-term, huge fraud where he is chapter by chapter rewriting American history to suit his Whiggish needs. So this week, he was both on NPR and he was in the New York Times. And on NPR, he talked about how morality is a politeness of the soul. See, the gays. Now, what does Lincoln have to do with the gays? Well, there's a theory that Lincoln was gay, but that's nothing to do with it. It has to do with the fact that in Indiana, what David Brooks thinks the gays should do is shut up already. He's very nice about it. But he goes, you know, morality is a politeness of the soul. And it's the polite thing to do. It's the nice thing to do to not be so pushy. You're getting what you want. You know, it's coming. Just be patient, calm down, which is in direct stark contrast to what he wrote about anti-Semitism the week before.
I also find it amazing in terms of timing that it was he published that on the weekend of the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it was almost, you know, the tone was exactly the same as the letter that Martin Luther King was responding to in a letter from a Birmingham jail. All these ministers writing to Martin Luther King in jail, who's sitting in jail in Birmingham, and saying, you know, be patient, be calm, we're on your side, we'll get there.
Eventually.
And, you know, morality of the soul.
Mm-hmm. So David Brooks in 1 week is writing, because the Jewish David Brooks 1 week is writing about how you must fight anti-Semitism. Maybe you might have to bomb a country. You might have to take to the streets and have nonviolent protests, but you must fight anti-Semitism all the time because it's a great, horrible, immoral, awful thing. The next week, when it comes to human rights for another group that David Brooks isn't a part of, gay rights, suddenly it's, hey, let's everybody calm down. Be cool, man. It's coming. Don't be patient. Jesus. slow your roll, baby. It's showing up. And to make his point, because he happened to read a book about Lincoln, he drags Lincoln into it.
And he needs to write 800 words.
He really needs to write 800 words. So what does he do? Right. So the first one was Abraham Lincoln. I'm now going to quote you. He says clearly, it's like Abraham Lincoln. The next sentence, I'm not drawing the parallel, but apparently you don't know what the word parallel means, because when you say it's like Lincoln, you're drawing a parallel. Look it up in the New York Times style book. It's in there. Ask someone who actually writes for a living and is edited by other people, David. They'll tell you what a parallel is. So Abraham Lincoln knew when to push abolitionism. It was clearly a moral right, but sometimes you have to push it gently. Sometimes you put your foot on the brakes, sometimes on the gas. And then it's a matter of pragmatically, how do you move forward? Yeah, Lincoln put his foot on the brakes, and then he put his foot on the gas. Then he put his foot on the throat of the Confederacy and choked it until it died.
Yep.
So apparently David Brooks didn't get to the end of the Lincoln story, where he dispatched hundreds of thousands of Union troops to the South to burn it to the ground. So I don't know where the fuck this comes from, but he really needs Gaines to stop being so pushy, and he's read a book by Lincoln, so let's just conjoin the two.
Yeah.
And then the second column, which, because, you know, I've read a book by Lincoln, now let's make up another column, is a long, longing tribute to the virtues of Abraham Lincoln, in which David Brooks writes what candidates need. Uh-huh. And what candidates need, and he writes this long, very nice letter about they need to have a golden temperament and a shrewd strategy, and they
and
need
$31
to be...
million dollars in a week. No, he didn't say that.
No, he didn't. But he doesn't talk about anybody in particular. But he talks about how Lincoln was slow to anger and how Lincoln never hated.
Just like Rand Paul. Oh, wait.
but here's the thing. He writes this long column about Lincoln and then says, we will not get a Lincoln. A person with his face could not survive in the TV age. A person with his capacity for introspection could not survive the 24/7 self-branding. But we need someone with a portion of his gifts. In other words,
A president that is doing all that.
That's what 300 people in the comments section said. Which, of course, David Brooks doesn't read because David Brooks doesn't want to hear the shit that, David, you're insane. You're an idiot. David Brooks doesn't listen to shit like that. Yep. David Brooks has written columns and been interviewed and says, no, I don't read my email. I don't read the comments. I don't read mean things people have to say about me because, frankly, why should he? Yeah. He's been lying like this for years, and he still get paid every week by three or four different sources. So why would he give it up? But the idea that he writes this long column about all these nice features a president should have, about a president who has those exact features in exactly those proportions, which bugs the shit out of me, I'll tell you, but doesn't bother him. And reminding ourselves that David Brooks, for the first year and a half of the Obama administration, this is what I was reminded of in reading through my archives, David Brooks backed Barack Obama as long as Obama's strategy was to, quote unquote, fix Washington using the blueprint that David Brooks gave him.
Yeah.
Which was, give them everything they want. Never fight, never push back, capitulate. Just keep giving the right everything it wants. Don't argue with them. Be nice, be humble, be gracious. Just keep letting them punch you in the dick and take your lunch money forever. And somehow this will make Washington a better place. And about 2 years into this strategy, Barack Obama began to gently push back against the theory that the way to handle crazy people is to capitulate to them forever.
Well, and let's not forget that 2 years into it was when the 2010 Congress took office.
Yeah.
And the House of Representatives was actually being run by crazy people.
Yes.
And, so he had to push back.
And he very gently pushed back against it. And David Brooks wrote a hysterical, tearful breakup with Barack Obama that said, I'm a sap. I was misled. He said he'd fix Washington. He didn't want to fix Washington at all. Now we're back to the status quo, with Democrats being wrong on one side, Republicans being wrong on the other, and everybody being equally wrong and intransigent all the time. David Brooks's language is the language of Washington. The reason I focus on David Brooks is he really is the king of this particular worldview. It is, on the one hand, always urge liberals to lay down your arms, always urge capitulation, and ignore the fact that the right is run by Rush Limbaugh.
I don't listen to Rush Limbaugh. He's an entertainer.
And every time something goes wrong, something breaks, when the right is responsible, blame the hippies, blame both sides, blame the 60s, blame everybody else. The minute liberals push back, the minute Barack Obama pushed back even gently, the humble, reticent, calm, reasonable, morally polite David Brooks had a fucking hissy fit in the New York Times op-ed section and just tore up all of his love notes to Barack Obama and burned them. And a couple of months later, threw himself into the arms of Mitt Romney. So the reason I dwell on this is that David Brooks really is the problem. I mean, he in the article we read about Rush Limbaugh, we're not going to cover that. It was Rush Limbaugh is a problem, but he has many little imitators. Mm-hmm. He has metastasized on the right. David Brooks is the problem, but he has metastasized. His language of always blaming both sides when it's the conservatives who are at fault and always freaking out whenever anybody pushes back on that worldview and hiding out like the coward that he is in venues where nobody will ever ask him any hard questions. That is how Washington works now. Yeah. That is how our media works now. And the reason he has a job presiding over NPR, PBS, Meet the Press, New York Times, lecturing, now he's on a book tour on how to build good character, is that he's the king of this. He's the king of the big lie that makes all the little lies possible. And that's why I've been focusing on him all these years.
Yeah. Thank you, Driftglass.
You're welcome, Blue Gal.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitties, plural, are Eddie and Finn. They're Irish. They love it, Driftglass, when you say fuck David Brooks. And their mother, while anonymous and unknown, was a saint, damn you.
She was a saint, damn it.
They don't know who their father was either.
He was a martyr to the tribbles. 400 years of canine oppression.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, or you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service. Go postal unions and fuck Rand Paul. Letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with an occasional contribution, and you can too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details, and we really do appreciate your support. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, you know, Blue Gal, the internet kitties are very excited. Jeb Bush says they get to register to vote as Hispanics.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with a switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2015, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Science Fiction University, we're finally back to Dogfaced Herman. Yay!
Yay!
Thank you, Dogfaced Herman. He sent us some really random stuff in this one.
Uh-huh.
It's all kind of science fiction, comic book, pop culture related, but this is definitely a potpourri of weirdness, so I just ask you to brace yourself for that. The likelihood is you're not going to get a lot of these, but we'll see.
I'm girding my loins.
All right, and just, you know, anything you recognize in them, let us know, and we'll grade this on a curve. All right, Driftglass?
Yeah, that sounds fair to me. I like curve grades. Yeah.
All right, let's try this. This is a song. I'll just tell you that. I didn't hear it on the radio, but this is a song. And tell me what you recognize about it. All right?
All right.
Number one.
Please, Boy Wonder, please come next Saturday and sleep for a week or two. I will feed you breakfast in bed. I will make your bed for you. And I like you so much that I want you to spend the whole summer with me. I hope you know this is a girl writing.
Okay, I will tell you that that's obviously about Batman.
That's about Batman, the Boy Wonder, yes.
Boy Wonder. And that sounds an awful lot like Boy Wonder himself, Burt Ward.
It is Burt Ward.
Little Burt Ward.
Can you believe that?
Well, it would make sense because, you know, they were capitalizing like mad off that stuff.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted to be on Batman. Everybody wanted to be part of the show. beyond that, I have no idea what the hell that's from.
It's a song called Boy Wonder I Love You from 1967 with Burt Ward and Frank Zappa.
Oh, my God.
I know.
Oh, my God. Well, first of all, I know after we're done recording, I have to go look up what album that's on, if it's on any album at all.
I don't know.
Because then I have to blow in a call to Brad. My Frank Zappa expert, the guy who turned me on to Frank Zappa. And then once I started getting into Frank Zappa, he started rolling his eyes going, Zappa, Captain Beefheart's where it's at, man. You know, he was always one hipster step ahead of me. So,
well, apparently this was a single.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, it was a single. It was just a single.
Okay.
And it's
and it launched Burt Ward's career as a...
The Boy Wonder Sessions, produced by Frank Zappa. Yeah. It's a Burt Ward album.
Now, do you have the Japanese import of that?
No, I don't know what the deal is. No. Amazing. Oh, did you know that Burt Ward turned down the role of the Graduate later given to Dustin Hoffman? Wouldn't that have been amazing?
Oh, man. Oh, okay. Man.
There's so much you learn from doing this. All right.
Okay.
Number two. This is a television special.
Okay.
Two people in it. Tell us what you know about it.
Little boy, there's no need to run. You'll never find an escape. I've already told you that.
I've had enough. I'm getting out of here.
No, you can't do that. You'll miss the best part. I've saved it for the last.
Oh, that's the inimitable Vincent Price, about whom I've spoken earlier on this podcast. And Alice Cooper. That has to be Alice Cooper.
That's Alice Cooper.
There's nobody, because that time and that period in that music, late 70s, early 80s, something like the Billion Dollar Baby period.
This is 1975.
Okay. All right.
All right.
But yeah,
The Nightmare television special with Alice Cooper and Vincent Price, 1975. All right.
Who else is going to put Vincent Price on but Alice Cooper? Come on.
Number three. Who's this group of people?
Betty, could you hold all calls, please? Thanks. Well, Delphar 7. How was planet Earth?
Fine.
So, is there something you'd like to tell me? Something you'd like to get off your chest? Something you've done recently?
No, I can't think of anything, no.
No, you can't. Have you read my memo?
Well, actually, I just got back. I really haven't had the opportunity.
Actually, there is a little something, and I don't even know why I'm bothering to bring it up. Really small, actually. Which one? Yes. Yes, this is it. Word is, you destroyed planet Earth. And apparently, this is the 12th one this month, and, well, they're a little worried upstairs. You know those big wigs? They're wondering if you're cut out for this particular surveillance job, and that... Oh, when I hired you... I just stressed that this was a surveillance job and not a planet-destroying job. Was it my fault? Was it me? Did I not make it clear?
Have there been complaints about my work? Is that it?
No. No, there haven't been any complaints. No. Anyone who might have complained has been blown up. You see the problem?
Oh, come on. I'm crushing your head. I'm crushing your head. I'm pinching your face and I'm crushing your head. It's the Kids in the Hall.
It's Kids in the Hall. That's kids right.
Has to be. I don't recognize the skit, but that's them, baby.
Yeah,
that's
they blew them. Up the earth. All right. Number four.
And hold on. Wind intensity. Too strong.
Quick, man. Cling tenaciously to my buttocks.
Both of them?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea.
This is Powdered Toast Man from Ren and Stimpy with Frank Zappa.
Oh,
Powdered
okay.
Toast Man with Frank, more Frank Zappa. He did anything. As long as it was weird and funny and fun, he would
do it. So the wise Science Fiction University person will catch on that, like Dwight Eisenhower and Ernest Hemingway, in Trivial Pursuit, the answer is often Frank Zappa.
It's often Frank Zappa in Science Fiction University. That is true.
And why wouldn't it be, really?
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Here's a surprising one. I love this one.
Okay.
See if you can recognize the show.
All right.
I will tell you this is a radio show.
Okay. All right.
If you can recognize any of the personalities in it.
Once again, an internal argument ensues.
How could you leave Sue out there to tackle the Miracle Man alone?
Because she wanted it that way, Twerp, remember? Now shut up and let us think.
Simmer down, Thing, and you too, Johnny. When Sue signals us, we've got to be ready.
Ready? I'm always ready. The next time I get within grabbing distance of that fancy faker, I'll make mincemeat out of him. He thinks his powers are greater than ours. Well, they ain't. Nothing's more powerful than those cosmic rays that turned us into what we are. I'm nothing more than a walking, fright show, an ugly, gruesome thing. What about me?
You've changed back to your normal self for a few minutes.
It might happen again for a longer time.
I don't want to be normal for a few minutes. I want to be Ben Grimm permanently. I want women to look at me and smile instead of screaming.
Chicks look at you? Don't kid yourself. They wouldn't look at you if you looked like Robert Redford.
Well, you cruddy little punk. I'll take you.
Hey, lay off, you big ape. I was only fooling around.
Yeah, me too.
Don't get crazy, Thing.
Think I'm crazy, do you? Well, what do you think it is?
I warned you. If it's a fight you want, play mine. Then that's what you'll get.
Okay, you two, let's not get out of control.
Yeah?
Okay, that's, well, you can tell it's a radio show. All the sound effects are crammed into the microphone, so you can tell it's a radio show. It's the Fantastic Four. It's obviously
the Fantastic Four.
It sounds eerily familiar. I'm guessing, I have no idea who any of the characters are. Maybe the narrator is, maybe, if the timing is right, Rod Serling, but that's just a guess on my part.
No.
And kind of a
This is the Fantastic Four. Apparently, there were 10 to 13 episodes for radio, made in 1975.
Oh, yeah.
The narrator is Stan Lee.
Oh, Jesus. Really? That's
and
wonderful.
The Human Torch is played by Bill Murray.
The Bill Murray?
The Bill Murray plays the Human Torch.
Well, if it's 1975, I forget when he went on Saturday Night Live, but if it's 1975 and it's Bill Murray... Bill Murray is, a Chicago area guy. I'm wondering if they recorded this anywhere in or near the Chicago area. If it might have been near my house when this was going on at that time.
In 1974, he moved to New York City and was recruited by John Belushi as a featured player on the National Lampoon Radio Hour.
Ah, that makes perfect sense.
I don't know if these were done for that, though.
No, that wouldn't. That
doesn't sound like it. These were after that.
Yeah, but once you're running with that crowd, anything's possible.
Yeah, anything's possible. Let's make something with Stan Lee. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the Human Torch rarely wears underwear. But when he does, it's something flameproof.
Yeah, of course it is, because, he's on fire down there. Okay. All right, you're going to recognize this music immediately.
Really? Okay.
But Dogface Herman wants to ask you, what makes this song science fiction?
All right.
So I'll just play a few seconds of it. All right, what is it?
Oh, it's Mission Impossible.
It's Mission Impossible.
I know the theme song from Bonanza has words, and I know the theme song from Star Trek has words. I don't think the theme song from Mission Impossible has any words.
The theme song from Star Trek has words?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Really? Yeah. And Bonanza, I would sing a little bit of it for you, but it's not science fiction. Blue Gal.
Yeah.
Bonanza, not science fiction. I have no idea. What would make it? And maybe a theremin? Is there a theremin in the background?
Nope.
Reaching here.
Lalo Schifrin wrote the theme to Mission Impossible.
Okay.
And he said of this music, things are written in 2/4 or 4/4 time because people dance with two legs. I wrote this song for people from outer space who have five legs.
Jesus. Okay. All right. Dogface Herman.
Yeah.
Especially for you, the Hugo Award for complete trivia mastery for bizarro knowledge goes to you, sir. I will present it to you at some future date along with a beer, probably just a beer, but that's awesome. That's just awesome.
He does. He wins that Hugo Award for obscurity in science fiction trivia, doesn't he?
That,
yeah.
And I'm just going to be waiting around. I don't go to a lot of parties, but I'll just be waiting around at a party one of these days, waiting for the conversation to nudge the conversation in the direction of the Mission Impossible theme song.
You know, let me tell you something you didn't know about Mission Impossible theme song. You know what? It's science fiction. I'll tell you why. And that's when the party. Oh, we got to go. Party's over. Sorry.
Gotta go. Mm-hmm.
Well, at least it wasn't Frank Zappa. So that's, what can I say?
Awesome. Thank you, Dogface Terman. And we'll be back next week with more Science Fiction University.
Bye.
I love you, Driftglass. Bye.
Love you, beautiful. Bye.